It's 6:03 in the morning. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, coming to you live, of course, this and every day of the work week from 6 a.m. till 9. So nice to have you with me. Thank you for letting me be part of your listening day. As Philip J. Vandervoort III would say, it's Friday Eve here on the commute. And by the way, Philip J. will be back on Monday. He needed a week to grieve. Of the news I gave you last week that I'll be retiring in April. However, we do have the very capable young Zach with us filling in this morning.
Good morning. We sent Phil on a scouting mission. Yes. He's scouting for talent.
Fact finding. Yes. And do we have both local and state and national news to bring your way? Let us start with the latest. You know, a couple of days ago, we brought you the story about, because it was causing a massive traffic jam on Highway 167. That's the north-south route that parallels I-5 here from Renton, clear down almost to Puyallup. There was an 8-mile backup on Highway 167, when a wrong-way driver headed in the northbound lanes going south. Anyway, collided with a truck, the driver of the car killed, which, of course, requires extensive police, firefighters, you know, criminal investigation, et cetera, all that going on. Well, this morning, a Washington State trooper may have prevented that from happening again on I-90. Just a couple of hours ago, driver got onto I-90 right off 405 and was headed the wrong way, swerved to avoid a state trooper coming from the opposite direction. The trooper intentionally hit the car going the wrong way with their own vehicle and brought it to a stop near Westlake Sammamish Parkway. The trooper was injured, the driver also injured, but both cases, the injuries were minor, and the driver is suspected to have been under the influence of something. Farron Zahn from Como 4 has more of the details.
Amazingly, in all of this, no one was seriously hurt, but certainly it was just scary for some time this morning. Wrong way driver traveling eastbound on the westbound lanes of I-90. An innocent driver swerving to get out of the way of that driver, again, going the wrong way. And then a trooper dispatched to stop that driver, the trooper doing what their training tells them to do. In a last case scenario, you got to put your trooper vehicle in front of that wrong way driver. And that's exactly what that trooper did, colliding head on with that car. In fact, at one point, before the impact, that wrong-way driver was swerving to try to avoid the trooper to continue going the wrong way, but the trooper did not let that happen. Even though it was a head-on impact, there's not serious injuries in all this.
Wow, no serious injuries, and I'll tell you something, that trooper is a hero. This is, you know, another example where they put their life on the line. Right before that collision, that trooper had no idea how extensively his or her injuries were going to be. We don't know the identity of the trooper. Boy, I want it broadcast far and wide when we do. This trooper's a hero.
Line here, Como just added, the car was going 60 miles per hour when they collided.
60. That's fast. And, of course, that's just their vehicle going 60. The trooper's vehicle also going who knows how fast, but that's how people die. This trooper knew that an injury was in front of him or her, at the very least, did it anyway. And again, thank God that the trooper has only minor injuries. The impaired driver also minor injuries. But this story could have had a very tragic, different ending had that driver managed to avoid the trooper and continued on their way. Again, that driver had swerved to avoid another car that was coming the other way. And who knows if they were on some sort of mission to do damage, to inflict carnage. Who knows? The traffic tie-ups would have been nightmarish on I-90 if there had been a terrible collision. But the bottom line is it was all stopped because of the heroic actions of this trooper. So, again, I cannot wait to hear the identity. We We believe that trooper deserves a lot of gratitude and thanks. It is 9:30 after 6. We love hearing from KVI listeners, of course. You can reach us by text or by phone call. Same number, 206-421-5757. That is 206-421-5757. We've been focusing a lot on what's happening on the national picture, and there's so much happening that, yes, we've got more to tell you about what you might not have known when you went to bed last night that has happened, because I don't think Donald Trump ever sleeps. But we also want to carve out some time to talk about what's going down in Olympia, the state capitol, right now. A legislative session is now, of course, well underway, about a third of the way through its 105-day session. And we'll basically take the temperature on five major issues and let you know what they're looking like. I mentioned stuff happening in Washington, D.C. Here's what I'm talking about. My goodness, it looks like Kash Patel is on the verge of becoming the new director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The Senate will be voting later today on his confirmation as FBI director. That vote would not have been called unless the Senate Majority Leader, John Thune, who replaced Mitch McConnell. John Thune is from the state of South Dakota, and he believes that Kash Patel has the votes. He cleared the Senate Judiciary Committee last week by a 12-10 party line vote. The Senate will be voting for him this afternoon, D.C. time. So you'll get the details either late in Lars Larson's show or early in Ari Hoffman's show. The Republicans control the Senate 53-47, and it looks like all or almost all of those senators will be, 53 Republicans will be supporting Kash Patel. Kash Patel is controversial precisely for two reasons. Number one, he is very competent, and he knows what needs to be done to reform the FBI. That's why the Democrats didn't want him. The same reason they opposed the new budget, the new director of OMB, the budget office, because he had previously been a budget director. He knows where the proverbial bodies are buried. Kash Patel knows who the troublemakers are in the Justice Department. By troublemakers, I mean people who are using law enforcement agencies as political weapons. So this is going to be good. And I love the idea that Kash Patel will be able to right the ship of state. The FBI, I should point out, my mom used to work for the FBI when she was a very young woman in Washington, D.C. in her early 20s. And she actually received an Employee of the Month award and got a signed picture from J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI at that time. I revered the FBI growing up. I remember there was even a television show at the time starring Ephraim Zemblis Jr. called The FBI. And the FBI used to actually help shape each week's episode with, you know, information and suggestions. It was an agency with a stellar reputation. And that has changed in the last 8 years because it has been politicized, not from field agents, not from their field offices around the country, but from the top down in Washington, D.C. And that is where Kash Patel is going to be concentrating his activities. Good on him. He worked as a counterterrorism official at the National Security Council. He was chief of staff to the defense secretary. And it was Kash Patel who helped debunk the entire ridiculous and absurd conspiracy that Donald Trump was in cahoots with the Russian government to illegally rig the 2016 presidential election. So, again, it was Kash Patel who helped uncover that conspiracy theory as being nothing more than a conspiracy theory. In other words, he debunked it. So it will be good to see someone who knows what the score is, knows how to get the job done in the nation's capital, heading the FBI. It is 15 minutes now after 6 o'clock in the morning. Here's another update for you. If you hadn't heard this, the passengers aboard that Delta flight that flipped upside down after landing in Toronto will be receiving compensation. I'm not talking about a lawsuit. I'm talking about Delta announcing $30,000 to each passenger. This money will not impact any future settlements if there are lawsuits, and there will be, I'm sure. But it is, again, how Delta is immediately trying to get in front of the PR fallout from this flight. Hold on.
This morning, as crews have finally cleared all the wreckage of this crashed Delta plane, the passengers on board will soon be receiving cash from Delta.
The representative that spoke to me said that this is no strings attached.
Brian Erickson was one of the 76 passengers on flight 4819. Delta will now be offering all of them $30,000 each.
There's some people in pretty tough shape, and $30,000 right now would be extremely helpful.
21 people were hurt, one of them still in the hospital, but miraculously everyone survived. Investigators now trying to determine what went wrong, if it was severe weather or human error. Delta CEO Ed Bastian speaking to CBS.
It was an experienced crew. All these pilots train for these conditions. They fly under all kinds of conditions at all the airports in which we operate.
So that's still a mystery. Again, just to remind you that when that flight was coming in last Sunday, when that flight was coming in, it was not in distress. There had been no problems on this flight from Minneapolis to Toronto. It was a routine flight. Everything was going fine until it touched down. And they didn't report any problems as they were coming in. You know, no wind shear or anything like that. It just came in. And then you've all seen the video. It hits the runway, and within seconds, you see flames. You see the plane lurching to the right. The wing of the aircraft on the right snaps off, and it rolls over. And all these passengers are suddenly upside down. It is a miracle that all 80 people, 76 passengers, 4 crew, that all 80 survived. It is also a miracle that here we are, what, 4 or 5 days later, and only one of them is still in the hospital? Everybody else is out? So, boys, say a prayer of gratitude on that one. But as you heard from ABC's Trevor Ault, every one of them gets $30,000. And if they don't have to, you know how it works. When you've been in an automobile accident and the opposing insurance company, you know, the insurance company for the person who hit you, if they're insured, will offer you a couple $100. Even if you're not injured, but you have to sign something that says, okay, you're not going to take any further legal action. That's not the case here. They get $30,000, period. No strings. You are listening to the radio program of record, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Still to come on the commute, the head of one of the biggest banks in the United States, Chase, wants his employees back to work. So there was a Zoom meeting where he tells everyone it's time to go back to work. And man, oh man, does he unload. Wait until you hear. And by the way, speaking of unloading, CNN's Brianna Kyler, who used to work in Tri-Cities in Eastern Washington and does not like Donald Trump in particular or Republicans in general. Anyway, she tried to tangle with Stephen Miller from President Trump's staff. I don't think that ended too well. We'll play that for you as well. There's a lot going on this morning, local and national, the commute with Carlson. Good morning. It's 26 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning, Thursday morning on the John Carlson Show. There is young Zach with the morning's first social media sweep. What a happening?
Well, what's happening is a social media sweep sponsored by the one and only Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Yesterday, I brought you a story of the Doge dividend proposal.
Yeah.
And I have an update on that. And what I love about this is Doge, from its inception, has been, you know, kind of by and for the people, right? And so the idea of the Doge dividend stems from just a tweet that I can only describe as just some guy made. I mean, he's got 50,000 followers, but in the world of Twitter, that's It's not huge.
Well, and some of them are White House insiders.
Sure.
So, in other words, he's connected.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this guy's not. No, this isn't. It's just a regular guy.
Isn't this the financial analyst?
Yes.
Okay.
But private sector and
yeah, no doubt about it. He's not part of the Trump administration.
Exactly.
You're absolutely
exactly.
correct.
So he just puts a tweet out saying, hey, President Trump and Elon Musk should announce this Doge dividend, which would be a tax refund. And he lays out his proposal. Elon Musk sees that tweet and says, I'll check with the president. Well, the president is weighing in now. And this is his comments to the I believe it was, why am I blanking on investment conference that happened yesterday. But here's Trump's comments on the Doge dividend.
There's even under consideration a new concept where we give 20% of the Doge savings to American citizens and 20% goes to paying down debt because the numbers are incredible, Elon. So many billions of dollars, billions, hundreds of billions. And we're thinking about giving 20% back to the American citizens and 20% down to pay back debt and pay down debt, which is, if you look at value, if it were a real estate balance sheet, the debt is tiny, but we still want to pay it down. Doesn't matter. We don't look at it as a piece of real estate. It's America. We're going to get it down through intelligence, hard work. And as Elon said, a word called caring. You have to care. By doing this, Americans will tell us where there's waste, they'll be reporting it themselves. Right. They participate in the process of saving money.
Exactly. Exactly. When Americans say, hey, wait a minute, Americans will actually get a rebate from some of the money saved? Yeah. Hey, listen, I know some waste. I work at a federal agency. I've seen waste all the time. This will actually encourage, rank and file federal employees and people who contract with the federal government and people who are spouses of people, in the federal government or people who know people working in the federal government to spotlight waste where it happens. I love the idea that you give, let's say, 20% of the findings of the savings in a tax rebate to America's 77 million households and then part of the money pay down debt, part of the money to lower the deficit, hopefully eventually to eliminate the deficit, though that will require more economic growth. And that we stay on this as, permanent footing, that we permanently are always looking for ways to spotlight waste. It's a wonderful concept because there's never been much of an economic incentive to get rid of the waste. And there's huge economic incentives to preserve it by the people who are responsible for the waste, the people who run these programs, who have these contracts. And so that is why previous administrations of both parties' attempts to get at government waste have either been limited successes or just failures. This can be different. This could be different if Americans find that they will economically benefit from helping to get rid of waste.
And it would, if we can give money back to the people, lower taxes along the way, and pay down the deficit, how can anybody be complaining about this?
Well, it goes, all those three things you just mentioned go in exactly the opposite direction of the last generation. It has been, I think, 1999 and maybe 2000 were the last times we had a balanced federal budget. We've been in deficit. And we have never grown the national debt as much as we have in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, we've added more debt than we did in the first 230-odd years that we've been a nation. So that is, if we were fighting another world war, yeah, then you take on debt. We haven't been fighting a world war. There was a pandemic in there, but the amount of the amount of debt that we have added helped spike inflation. And until we get inflation and interest rates down, the economy won't be firing on all cylinders. All right. It is 31 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning. When we come back, more and more Americans are heading back to the office. Work from home is becoming less and less of a routine reality. Mm-hmm. The John Carlson Show. Back we are. It's 23 minutes to 7 o'clock. So if you're a regular commuter, you may have noticed that roads are getting a little more busy than they used to be. There's still plenty of room on the bus. Transit ridership is still well over 30% under where it was 5 years ago. But they're a little more busy than they used to be. More people on the bus, a lot more people on the roads. And the reason for that is the share of people, the proportion of people who are working mostly back in the office has grown by leaps and bounds in just the last year. Amazon, last September, I think it was, said, go back. It's time to go back to work. Return to work. It's called RTO. Let's get going. And that created a wave. In other words, that meant it was safe for other large companies to start ordering employees back to work. Donald Trump added more momentum on his first day in office. He ordered federal employees back to work. I mean, some federal agencies in Washington, D.C. had less than 3% of their employees showing up for work. They were working, air quotes, from home. And so Trump issued an executive order, federal employees get back to work. Now, the White House did carve out an exemption for federal employees who have spouses working for the military. They can still work remotely. Others got to come back to the office. Some companies say you have to be back 5 days a week. Some companies say you have to be back 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But the momentum is clearly aiming at getting employees back to the office because, for one thing, it is better for the company itself. When you go to the office, you tend to be more focused and less distracted than if you're working from home. And secondly, it's not only better to have, in terms of a cohesive workforce, but the company becomes more productive because, as one business executive put it to me, sometimes it's not the conversation at the meeting that matters. It's the conversation after the meeting that matters. Can't have that conversation if it's by Zoom, the conversation after the meeting. So the numbers are clear. They say that average office occupancy hit 54% in January. That is a post-pandemic high, and the numbers continue to rise. Jamie Dimon is the CEO for JPMorgan Chase, used to be known as Chase Manhattan, and he wanted his employees back to the office. Now, Jamie Dimon has been on top of JPMorgan Chase, I think, for like 20 years. He's one of the most influential, powerful voices in the banking world. And he's even been mentioned as a potential candidate for president someday, though he himself says no interest. But I mean, that's the high air that he occupies in the business world. So he was on a Zoom call telling employees he wanted them to get back to the office. And New York business people, particularly on Wall Street, they tend to be a little salty with their language. So young Zach had to spend about 7.5 hours.
Man, I hope I got it all.
Editing what Jamie Dimon said. But here he is talking to his employees saying it's time to get back to work.
A lot of you were on the f-ing Zoom and you were doing the following, okay? Looking at your mail, sending texts to each other about what an asshole the other person is. Okay, not paying attention, not reading your stuff, and if you don't think that slows down efficiency, creativity, creates rudeness, and stuff, it does, okay? And when I found out that people are doing that, you don't do that in my goddamn meetings. You go to a meeting with me, you got my attention, you got my focus, I don't bring my goddamn phone, I'm not sending texts to people, okay? It simply doesn't work, and it doesn't work for creativity, it slows down decision-making, and don't give me the the work from home Friday works. I call a lot of people on Friday. They're not a damn person to get a hold of. But here are the problems, okay? And they are substantial, okay? Which is the young generation is being damaged by this. That means they may or may not be on your particular staff, but they are being left behind. They're being left behind socially, ideas, meeting people. In fact, my guess is most of you live in communities a hell of a lot less diverse than this room. Every area should be looking to be 10% more efficient. If I was running a department with 100 people, I guarantee you if I wanted to, I could run it with 90 and be more efficient. I guarantee you. I could do it in my sleep. And the notion, these bureaucracies, I need more people, I can't get it done. No, because you're filling out requests that don't need to be done. Your people are going to meetings they don't need to go to. Someone told me to approve some of his wealth management that they had to go to 14 committees. I am dying to get the name of the 14 committees. And I feel like firing 14 chairmen of committees. I can't stand it anymore. Now, you have a choice. You don't have to work at JP Morgan. So the people of you who don't want to work at the company, that's fine with me. I'm not mad at you. Don't be mad at me. It's a free country. You can walk with your feet, you know, but this company is going to set our own standards and do it our own way. And I've had it with this kind of stuff. And, you know, I come in, you know, I've been working 7 days a damn week since COVID. And I come in and where's everybody else? But they're here and there and the Zooms don't show up. And people say they didn't get stuff. So that's not how you run a great company. We didn't build this great company by doing that, by doing the same semi-disease shit that everybody else does.
Anyone think he's wrong? I think that he just gave voice to every business manager, every CEO in the country. I understand that it is often easier to work from home, more convenient to work from home. The question is, are you a more productive employee for your company when you work from home, or are you a more productive employee when you're at the office? I think that question answers itself. Keep in mind, it costs your company money to have an office. You know, if you have, you know, five floors in an office tower for your company, the company would have a much less expensive lease if it had three floors. So if it believed that fewer employees equaled a more productive workforce, they probably would be all in favor of working from home. And hey, we can make do on three floors and we just saved a ton of money. But that's not the reality for a lot of these companies. So good for Jamie Dimon. He said this a while ago, but I've been holding it. I've been wanting to play that for listeners because, again, I think you'll notice several times he mentioned that he's in the office, he doesn't see people, that he's on time for meetings, where's everybody else? He said, you know, I've been working, you know, blankety blank number of days here, and I don't see the input. I don't see the commitment. So this is someone who is leading by example and is frustrated that he still hasn't seen more people return to the office. Now they will. It is 6:47 in the morning. Our good buddy, Lars Larson, our noon to three host, right around the corner as the Commute with Carlson continues this Thursday morning. Talk Radio 570 KVI. All right, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, here on the John Carlson Show, we are not afraid to bring in contrary points of view. For instance, sometimes I'll bring on someone who is in alignment, full agreement with, say, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the U.S. Senate. Let me go to someone right now who is agreeing, finds himself agreeing with Chuck Schumer, and find out why. That would be Lars Larson, our noon to three host. There's an interesting alliance. I don't want to say.
Good morning, John.
Strange bedfellows.
Give me a little cognitive dissonance, to use some $5 words, to agree with Chuck Schumer on not one but two things.
Whoa.
Number one, Senator Schumer said yesterday, there is waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government, and he and I agree on that. And then he said something else that I agree with. He said, but we shouldn't take a meat axe to it. And we agree on that, because yesterday I said we ought to take a Javier Milei chainsaw to the waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government. So apparently Chucky and I agree on this, even though he's a New York Democrat and I'm a left coast conservative.
Well, and I like that you say chainsaws, because chainsaws are far more accurate than a meat axe. And the other thing, a difference between an axe of any kind and a chainsaw is, you know what? Chainsaws are quicker.
Yeah, they do. They do quick work. Mine works really well as long as I have a sharp chain on it. I have a stack of those chains that I sharpen because if I'm cutting something, I want to go through it like butter.
Yeah.
But this is what's crazy is the Democrats applauded Bill Clinton for making big cuts, 400,000 plus federal employees cut in the 90s. They applauded Barack Hussein Obama for making cuts. His cuts weren't as big, but he talked about how he's going to cut back the size of the federal government.
By the way, after reducing the federal workforce 400,000, it made it so much easier for Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress at that time under Newt Gingrich to have the first balanced budgets in decades.
And I think a balanced budget, I know it's it sounds crazy, but I think it's possible. You take the ideas applied to entitlements that the CEO of LexisNexis talked about, and they're very simple and reasonable ideas. He says you can cut a trillion there. Musk says you can cut a trillion out of waste, fraud, and abuse, the advisor to the president, not, as the Democrats want to say, the pseudo-faux president of the United States. He's just an advisor. But he apparently he's giving good advice to Donald Trump, and we're already saving tens of billions.
It is coming up on 5 minutes to 7 o'clock. When we come back on The Commute with Carlson, we have the state Republican chairman, Jim Walsh, but more important, also a state legislator who's going to give us an update on several bills, several major issues, including the rapidly growing parents' rights movement and why that is happening. You're not going to want to be anywhere else but right here, 570 KVI. It's coming right up. And we're back, as promised. Hour number two, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. You know, one of the things that I take great pride in on this show is unparalleled coverage of state and local issues. Yes, we cover the historic actions and activities going on in Washington, D.C., but we also keep an eye on what's happening right here in our front yard and let you know what is often missing from the rest of the news media. Five issues in Olympia have galvanized my attention. One of them is a road usage charge, which basically is a toll for driving that Olympia would like to pass. Another is rent control. Another is an ongoing attack on the initiative process. A fourth is an attempt to triple, not double, triple the amount of property tax collections allowed for local and county government. And there's the increasingly, rapidly growing parents' rights movement, which has been ignited by an attack on an initiative that the legislature voted for 1 year ago, less than 1 year ago, they voted for it. And now they're trying to dismantle it. The backlash has been, well, let's just say heartening. And Jim Walsh, state representative, and of course,
because I'm a
Republican
smooth legislator,
is with us to talk about it. Jim Walsh, we got your own theme music here for you.
that's great, John. That sets me up. Well, I don't know how it sets me up, John.
You're a smooth legislator.
I try to be smooth. On some days we achieve it, and some days we don't.
Well, welcome.
Yes, there's a lot going on.
Okay.
A lot going on in Olympia.
I want to start with the parents' rights movement and the status of the attack on the initiative, the dismemberment of the initiative that the legislature passed just a year ago.
And that really is the galvanizing piece. So, correct. Last year, there was an initiative to the legislature. So it started out with the people. And the petitions, people will remember signing it. It was Initiative 2081, and it created a Washington State Parents' Bill of Rights. It's important to point out that the Parents' Bill of Rights is primarily, really exclusively, about notification. It's about things that custodial parents or legal guardians of minor children must be told about that their children may experience, mostly related to school, but a number of the points in the Bill of Rights have to do with health care or mental health care. So if the child is seeing a therapist or a counselor, the parents have to be informed. Now, it doesn't touch other elements of the law. It's simply about notification and information. the parents have to be told. It passed through the legislature nearly unanimously. In the state Senate, it was unanimous. And then in the state House, it was about an 85-12 vote or something like that. So overwhelmingly bipartisan, almost unanimous, became law. Now, some of the legislators on the far left are trying, as you say, to overturn it. They have a bill in the state House and a bill in the state Senate that each try to overturn the Parents' Bill of Rights. And they've made some very misleading arguments about overturning it. And one state senator in particular, Senator Peterson out of Seattle, has really gotten caught in the spokes of the thing by giving a couple of ill-advised media interviews where he said things that are simply false. And it has energized just not just legislators, but the people in a good way. I believe that we will either stop the attacks on the Parents' Bill of Rights, or if one happens to slip through, I believe there will be other action, maybe another initiative, maybe other action in response that will be stronger still. So no, that's great.
The real news would be not the attack on an initiative that was overwhelmingly passed by pretty much the same legislature.
Correct.
But the blowback when the legislature turned around and said, we're dismantling it. Here, by the way, is what Jamie Peterson, he's the Senate Majority Leader, is senator from the most liberal district in Seattle. We're talking Capitol Hill University District, part of South Seattle as well. Here is Jamie Peterson telling parents what rights they don't have.
Young women have, if they're old enough to get pregnant, they're old enough to make their own decisions about what happens with their bodies, okay? And parents do not have the right to change that or make a different decision or be notified in advance.
Or be notified. So a school can help a 14-year-old girl get an abortion. A school can help a 14-year-old girl get an abortion and not even notify the parents, let alone get permission. If the girl wanted her...
That is a false statement.
What?
That is a false statement. That's a false statement. That the Parents' Bill of Rights says the parents do need to be notified.
Right.
And it's good law. The ACLU and other groups went to court to try to get the Parents' Bill of Rights overturned. And even our left-leaning state courts here in Washington said no. The Parents' Bill of Rights is good law. It is unconstitutional. I'm sorry, it is not unconstitutional.
Fully constitutional.
And it's good law. So the statement that parents do not have a right to be notified, that is false.
And
they
then
do have a right to be notified.
And then he said that when it comes to mental health, 13-year-olds have a right to choose their own mental health treatment, and parents don't need to be part of that process. Parents don't even need to be notified. They have no such right. That's another thing Senator Peterson said, Jim.
Yes, and he's confusing two different sections of state law. One section says that in certain cases, minor children can get health care and other services without parental permission. That is true. That's a separate section of law. But the Parents' Bill of Rights says if the child is receiving the health care, including mental health care, the parents do have a right to be told that it's happening. So they are two separate issues in the law, two separate sections of the law. And the senator, in my opinion, I think he's doing it knowingly, but who knows?
No, he's a lawyer. He's a pretty good one, too. Jamie knows better than that.
Right. He's conflating these two issues to make a political point, and he's been caught. That's the main thing. The media, which often will ignore these kinds of political statements, actually has caught him on this. And so that has been helpful. It's been helpful in shining a light on some of the misleading types of political rhetoric that the left uses in Olympia. So this has been a good thing. I mean, it's been painful, John, but it's been a good thing in that we are able to show people how the left can be misleading. And it is translating into some better coverage and better responses,
right,
both in the media and in the legislature, to some of the other issues you mentioned.
Yes, we'll get to those in just a moment. But not only is he conflating, but he's also revealing. He is revealing the attitude of the opponents to parents' rights. It's almost this condescending attitude toward parents, Jim.
Yes.
You don't have a right to know these things. You don't.
And it is something that parents and families have sensed but not always known in our politics, that the left truly believes it knows better than parents and grandparents and family members, that they know better what a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old should be doing, how to raise that child. And it is a fundamental ideological blinder that these left-wing politicians have. And they've gone so far that they've kind of outed themselves. They've shown the arrogance and the condescension of their ideology.
Yes. So a couple of other issues we wanted to talk about here. Get the latest update as of this morning in Olympia. Let's start with what's called the RUC, the road usage charge, which would be basically a toll. Everyone would have to pay a 2.5 cent toll for every mile they drive. And then there's a tax on top of that tax that would be used for transit. What is the status of this bill? Well, because I heard that.
So this is an old dog trying to learn new tricks in Olympia. It is not a new idea. It is an idea that again, some left-leaning politicians in Olympia have been kicking around for a few years now. It is the RUC, the road utilization charge, also called the per mile tax. Some describe it as a toll, as you do. So it is the same idea, that in addition to paying a tax on the purchase of gasoline and diesel fuel, which you're already doing, you would pay this extra tax based on the number of miles you drive each year. In some cases, the mechanics of it are that you would, when you renew your car tabs once a year, you would have to report your mileage, and then the Department of Licensing would compare it to your mileage last year and put a surcharge on your tab renewal of hundreds or even thousands of dollars to get your new tabs each year. The other part of the proposal is you would actually put a device in your car or truck, a GPS device, that would track your mileage on a regular ongoing basis. Both options are very unpopular with people. The overwhelming public comment on the proposals has been negative. Right. When people have that chance to log on the internet and say, I'm for or I'm against this, overwhelmingly negative, 97-98% of thousands of responses say no.
200 people in favor when the hearing was held, 19,800, rounded up to 20,000. 200 for the road usage charge, 20,000 signing in opposed. That gives you an idea. So does this have a chance of passage?
I think it will not pass this year, John. They're not going to give up on the idea, but the popular outrage has been so strong about it. And we're at a time where other taxes are being increased at such a rate. I think even my very left colleagues in Olympia know that this is not ready for prime time. Let's be diplomatic. It's it's a cake that is not fully baked. I do not think it's going to pass.
Oh, right. That is good news. We've got a few minutes left here. Rent control. What is the status of rent control right now?
This one, I'm not as optimistic. This one may get through. This is another not new idea. Mm-hmm. The left has been trying to press for some form of rent control in Washington for years now. And I think this is a priority that they're not going to give up on. They want to create a system by which landlords, property owners, people who've got a house to rent or an apartment building they own, will be structured. They will be told by the state government what and how they can charge rent. It is a almost religious belief on the far left that this is a matter of justice and that property owners are greedy and conniving and exploiting renters. The problem with it, John, is we've seen in other places around the country where rent control has been experimented with, it creates more scarcity in apartments and houses to rent.
What they really need are more people in the apartment business. That's what they really
need. Correct. And we've got all these permitting and regulatory restrictions on building a new apartment building.
Okay.
That if you want to lower rents, let's increase supply. I mean, it's a supply and demand issue.
Okay, and this is for residents only, not for commercial buildings?
At this point, correct.
Okay.
But once you start this kind of regulatory apparatus and control, where does it stop?
Okay, we've got about a minute and a half left. The legislation to attack the initiative process passed committee in the Senate on Friday.
Correct.
What is
this? This one basically makes the signature gathering element of an initiative virtually impossible.
Right.
So they focus on the way that the petitions where you sign in support of an initiative, how those are run. It makes it very difficult for anyone to collect the signatures that qualify an initiative. And it's a bad faith piece of legislation. They say it's to create greater security and certainty among petition signers. Really what they're trying to do is kill the initiative process. And I'll point out, John, it's sort of ironic. The same far-left legislators who don't want any voter identification when people vote are saying now they want strict identification when people sign in support of an initiative.
Yeah, I know, perfect.
Well, fellas, if we're going to have it one way, we need to have it both ways. If we're going to have very strict rules about identification to sign an initiative, let's have strict rules about identification when people are voting.
And again, as that bill comes to the House, what do you think its chances of passage are?
I believe it's not a certainty. I believe it is such a bad, and in my opinion, bad faith bill. I think we're going to have some fun with it, and I think the other side may be unwilling to expose themselves for hypocrites to support that strict identification rule while voting has none.
45 seconds left, and the bill to triple from 1% a year without a public vote to 3% a year without a public vote, property tax collections at the local and county level. What are the chances that this will pass?
Again, not a new idea, been around for a few years. I do not think this is going to pass. Again, this is another one where the public outcry has been so strong against it.
Nice.
And, it, you know, property taxes are already rising at an untenable rate.
Sure.
I just think the time is wrong for this one, John.
And that is a good sign because it shows the public mood, not at all what progressive Democrats thought it was after the election in Olympia.
Correct.
That is a very good sign, isn't it?
It started with the parents' rights attacks, but the public has become awakened, become activated. And it's moving on now to these other issues where people are saying, no, 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 these are bad ideas. And that is very encouraging, John.
If people want to get more involved in this parents' rights fight, what would you recommend they do, Jim Walsh?
You can go to the state legislators' website. That's wa.leg.gov, wa.leg.gov. And you can track bills there. If you know the number, you can enter it on a menu and it'll bring up the details, or you can search by legislators' names, or you can search by topic. So the ledge.wa.gov website is a good website. It's something good the state government does.
Good place to start.
And it gives you that kind of open book for tracking bills by topic or by people involved.
State Representative and State Republican Chairman Jim Walsh, great review of the current status of these hot-button issues in Olympia. Thanks for joining us this morning, Jim.
Always good to talk to you, John. Be well.
You got it. It is 22 minutes after 7. Here we have young Zach with the social media sweep right around the corner. The Commute with Carlson continues. Good morning. 27 minutes after 7 o'clock. All right, young Zach with the social media sweep this morning. What do you seeing out there?
Well, I'd like to talk about one more piece of legislation that's had a hearing yesterday in Olympia. This is Senate Bill 5622, and doesn't on the surface seem like that big of a deal per se. It revolves around the restriction of sale of over-the-counter diet pills to folks over 18 or under the age of 18. And speaking of age restrictions, I believe you have to be 21 to go to the Muckleshoot Casino Resort, which sponsors this wonderful segment, and I would never forget to mention ever. But anyway, Senate Bill 5622. An act, it says right here, act relating to establishing restrictions on the sale of over-the-counter diet pills and dietary supplements for weight loss or muscle building to individuals under the age of 18. So check out a little bit of this audio from Senator John Levick as he describes why he feels we need to restrict the sale of these products to young people.
This legislation, Madam Chair, is about preventing negative outcomes for our youth. Children are being intentionally targeted by companies that claim to promote wellness while advertising and selling dangerous and untested products. Adolescents and young youth, young adults, women who use these pills have six times the risk of being diagnosed with an eating disorder. We need to restrict the sale of these types of supplements to individuals under the age of 18.
So, you know, fine enough, but contrast that audio with what we played a little bit ago, but I want to replay just a segment of it from another Senate Democrat, Jamie Peterson.
Young women have, if they're old enough to get pregnant, they're old enough to make their own decisions about what happens with their bodies. Okay?
But when it relates to small businesses selling supplements, God forbid young people get creatine.
Yeah. Or if you have a boy who wants to be a girl, and you want puberty blockers, well, that should be your choice.
Go for it.
Yeah, you should be able to do that. And again, here we have, because it would be done in the name of mental health and wellness. So that's okay, but a supplement to help you, you know, build your body, build your physique, no, that's a bad thing.
Absolutely.
Could we just have some consistency, please?
Yeah, I like I said, take or leave of the bill. I don't have an opinion either way, per se, but I thought that was awfully interesting to...
Well, it's like the legislation that, you know, in this legislative session to combat gun violence, there is a bill in Olympia that would restore the gun rights of drug felons. The same party that wants to make it harder for law-abiding people to buy a gun, the government needs to issue you a permit if you want to buy a gun, wants to restore gun rights to people who have been violent with guns in carrying out their drug dealing.
And maybe I'm wrong. I don't know how Senator Levick intends to vote on the Parental Bill of Rights, but I can assume, and I assume it will be a little different than his proposed legislation regarding dietary supplements.
You are listening to The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Something momentous has happened in American politics that has escaped notice from a lot of people. Not me, and in a few moments, not you either, when I tell you what is going on across this country when it comes to how people now identify themselves politically. No, I can't see Bob Seger on the disco floor either. All right. It is 23 minutes to 8 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I've been telling you about this. Hardly anyone else has. And I want to draw more attention to it because two interesting things are happening in American politics right now. The first is that Donald Trump continues to be popular with the American people, that his approval rating is still above 50%. It's been above 50% every day of his presidency. So we're coming up, you know, over 30 days now. He was only above 50% 11 days during his entire first term. So in 4 years, he was above 50% 11 days. In his second term, he's above 50% for all 30 days of his administration so far. What's going on? Because he's actually less popular with independent voters. He's underwater with independent voters by a 10 percentage point margin. By a 10 percentage point margin, more independent voters disapprove than approve. So you're probably thinking, well, wait a minute. Hold on. This doesn't make sense, John. Obviously, Donald Trump is overwhelmingly unpopular with Democrats. And he is. 85% disapprove. And more independents by a 10 percentage point margin disapprove of Trump than approve. So how could he possibly be above 50% with voters at large, even if he has the support of a lot of, you know, 90% of Republicans, which he does? Here's why. Because there are now more Republicans than Democrats in America, and that has not been the case since the 1930s. Here's CNN's Harry Enten. This is a big deal.
It's not just the margins that you post among these groups. It's what percentage of the electorate that they make up. And Donald Trump and the Republican Party has changed the electorate. What do I mean by that? Well, let's take a look at party identification, Democrats versus Republicans. You go back to 2017, 5 points more of the electorate was Democrats than Republicans. You go to 2021 when Joe Biden was starting out. Look at that. 6 points more of the electorate was Democrats than Republicans. But look at what's happened in February of 2025. Look at this. Republicans, there are more Republicans in the electorate than there are Democrats. Republican plus two. So Donald Trump and the Republicans have remade the electorate. They've turned some people over from being Democrats or independents to become Republicans. New folks have entered the electorate who are more Republican leaning. And so when you combine that with the fact that Republicans are really, really behind Donald Trump, all of a sudden you get a winning recipe whereby you break the normal rules of politics and give Donald Trump that positive net approval rating when he had pretty much a consistently negative one in term number one.
Republicans now outnumber Democrats. Donald Trump has not only remade the Republican Party, he's grown the Republican Party. Public sentiment is moving in a more conservative direction. The reason why I'm talking about this topic right now, right after I talked to Jim Walsh, you have commanding Democrat majorities in both houses of the legislature, and we have a Democrat governor. And yet, of the five issues that I talked about with Jim Walsh, parents' rights, road usage charge, rent control, attack on the initiative process, the idea to triple property tax collections for county and local government, the conservative position appears to be prevailing in four of them. You heard Jim Walsh, who laid it all out very well on how there has been an incredible backfire, boomerang effect when the legislature tried to dismantle the Parents' Rights Initiative. And so that appears to be going in the direction of those who qualified that initiative for the ballot and would certainly have voted it through. The road usage charge, the Democrats were stunned at the intensity of the opposition to a road usage charge, which is basically a toll. You would be paying 2.4 cents for every mile you drive. They haven't figured out how they would calculate how far you drove. They say, oh, we'll use the honor system. So really, how well is the honor system using when it comes to, say, paying Sound Transit fares? So there's that. And the road usage charge appears to be going nowhere. The attack on the initiative process, again, has resulted in a fierce backfire, in a fierce counterattack. And the idea of allowing local governments to triple from 1% a year to 3% a year, triple property tax collections at the city level and at the county level and at every other level of local government that gets property tax revenue. So your property tax would be up and up and up and up some more. That doesn't appear to be going anywhere either. The sole exception to the rule at this point is rent control. Rent control appears to be headed toward passage. The other four appear to be heading in a more conservative direction. There's an interesting poll out. It is from Gallup. It was conducted late last month. And they asked people, you know, in the wake of the election, should Democrats double down on being more liberal, more activist, or should they be more moderate? Now, here's the skinny on this. They only asked Democrats and Democrat-leaning independents to participate in the poll. And what the results came back, 45% of Democrat voters say they want their party to moderate. Only 29% of Democrats want a more liberal party. Again, only 29% of Democrats, call that your progressive base, only they, the Pramila Jayapals, they want a more liberal party. 45%, that's a 16 percentage point difference, 16 percentage point gap. 45% of Democrats are with Adam Smith. They say, no, we need a more moderate party. You know, this whole, defund the police, open the borders. No, the American people are tired of this. They don't want this. And so the media aren't playing this up. You know, they're trying to create a fight between Donald Trump and Elon Musk, and it ain't working. they've been so over the top obvious about trying to make this happen, and it's failing. But the real battle that is happening beneath the surface, and sooner or later it's going to break out, is the battle between progressive Democrats who are taking their party over a cliff, witness Seattle, witness Portland, witness San Francisco, versus, if you will, moderates and standard issue liberals, like the folks who now make up a majority of the Seattle City Council. So that battle is going to be continuing, and it's not going to be under the surface here on KVI. I'm telling you all about it, but it's still, for the most part, under the surface when it comes to most media coverage about what's going on in American politics. All right. It is Boeing time on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Boy, do we have a lot more to talk about. A lot more to talk about nationally, a lot more to talk about locally. The commute continues. It's 7:53, 7 minutes to 8 o'clock, the John Carlson Show. I don't know if you are aware of the names of Kafir Bibas and Ariel Bibas, who's 4 years old. Their mother, Sherry Bibas, she was just 32. They were taken hostage by Hamas on October 7th. There's the photographs of the mother holding them, blanket wrapped around all three of them, and they disappeared into Gaza, controlled by Hamas. Well, Hamas released they were among the 250 hostages. They were released yesterday, dead. Hamas took possession of an 8-month-old baby boy, a 4-year-old toddler, their mother, and returned them dead. What have I told you about these people, Hamas? I've told you these people are barbarians. They paraded the dead bodies of Sherry, Ariel, and Kafir in coffins, carried them around. The coffins were black, labeled with each hostage's photo, and their, quote, arrest date, close quote. They blame Netanyahu for their death. Hamas locked the caskets and did not provide Israel with keys to open them. They had to inspect the coffins to make sure they weren't booby-trapped. Crowds of Palestinians gathered to watch the coffins being paraded, whistling and listening to loud music. Hamas terrorists stood behind the bodies, the caskets of a baby, a toddler, and their mother, posing with automatic weapons. What I tell you, these people are barbarians. Absolute bottom-of-the-barrel barbarians. I hope Israel wipes the floor with Hamas, ends Hamas, finish them once and for all once this entire hostage exchange is over. This just makes my blood boil. A mother and two little kids killed in Hamas captivity. Hour number three of the commute, straight ahead. Oh, coming up on 4 minutes after 8 o'clock, Thursday edition. Hour number three already, young Zach? See how fast the time flies here? When you're in the booth?
I tell you.
Zach, of course, sitting in for Philip J. Vandervoort III, who fled after last week's news that I would be retiring in April. He will be back on Monday. We've hooked him up with a counselor. All is working well. We think we will talk him back into work.
His therapy dog is in training as we speak.
Yes. Unfortunately, the therapy dog won't be available until next week when he's already supposed to be here. But anyway, it's the thought that counts there. The commute with Carlson, of course, every day of the work week from 6 to 9. You can always let us know what's on your mind by texting us the KVI text line, which also happens to be our phone line. That would be 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. Want to go back to Monday. There was, again, Monday was a holiday, and there was that dramatic and almost catastrophic Delta Airlines crash at Pearson International Airport in Toronto. You've all seen the video by now. The plane coming in for a landing had not indicated any distress, had not indicated anything wrong. It was just a routine flight from Minneapolis to Toronto, and then almost immediately after touching down, looked like a hard landing, you saw flames from the rear of the aircraft, and then the right wing of the aircraft hit the runway and sheared off, at which point the plane itself rolled over, probably going, I don't know, 130, 140 miles an hour, and came to rest. Miraculously, it did not catch fire. It came to rest upside down, everyone inverted, 76 passengers and 4 flight crew. Nobody died. 21 of the 80 people on board had to go to the hospital, but they're all out of the hospital now except one person. And everyone's talking about what a miracle it was. So here's the question that I want to know. How did they survive? How did this happen where you've got a hard landing, then the plane goes sideways and skids, and the plane literally comes apart and rolls over, comes to rest upside down. So the ceiling is now the floor. Investigators are still trying to figure out why the plane crashed, whether it's a mechanical issue, whether it's human error. We'll find out eventually. But how did they all manage to live? Well, there's a number of reasons for it. The director of Cranfield University's Aerospace and Aviation Department in Great Britain said that the fact that they managed to live tells you a lot about how the restraints worked, how the aircraft design worked, how the rescue teams responded, how the cabin crew did their jobs. He said, keep in mind, planes are designed to be crashworthy and to protect people to the greatest extent possible. So that is one reason why the seats did not detach from the floors when they were hanging upside down. It's one reason why the seatbelts actually kept the passengers secure. That's one reason why when passengers likely hit the seat in front of them, think about what the seat looks like in front of you when you're flying. The surface of the seat in front of you is constructed in such a way that it makes it less likely you'd suffer a serious injury. Eyewitness accounts, according to the Washington Post, suggest that the seatbelts managed to keep many people secure hanging upside down immediately in the aftermath. A paramedic who was on the flight said he found himself physically upside down before he took his seatbelt off. Then you have the work done by the crew, the cabin crew. The design criteria is that everyone should be able to be evacuated off an airplane in 90 seconds or less in an emergency. But keep in mind, they had to evacuate an aircraft that was upside down. First responders on the scene were able to quickly put out spot fires. By the time emergency crews reached the passengers, most of them had already gotten off the plane. They'd self-evacuated. There's videos showing the chaos in the immediate aftermath of the crash. Flight attendants were walking along what was once the ceiling, shouting for passengers to drop everything and exit through the emergency exit doors. When crews got there, they helped the passengers crawl out of the wreckage who were still on the plane. So the cabin crew were remarkably poised. And again, just a reminder that their chief mission as cabin crew members is, you know, not just to keep you comfortable and, you know, bring you, you know, food or something to drink. Their chief job is to keep you safe. Then you had passengers helping each other and passengers checking out each other. So it was, again, just a miracle. Everything worked out the way it did. But everybody seemed to do their job well. The passengers, for the most part, did not panic and even helped each other. The flight crew managed to run an evacuation process before the evacuation crews got there. The evacuation crews got there and the first responders putting out fires, spot fires. So again, it was a miracle, but everything worked the way it was supposed to. So that's why everyone on this plane survived.
I have a deep, profound question.
Yeah.
When the plane flips over, do you then lift down on the buckle of the seatbelt?
Well, let's put it this way. If you do and it doesn't open, you know the next thing to do, which is to pull it the other way. But Delta has announced that they are giving all the passengers on board. Did you hear about this, young Zach? A 10% discount on their next flight. So No, I'm teasing. They're giving them $30,000 unconditionally. Here, have a listen. This is ABC's Trevor Ault.
This morning, his crews have finally cleared all the wreckage of this crashed Delta plane. The passengers on board will soon be receiving cash from Delta.
The representative that spoke to me said that this is no strings attached.
Brian Erickson was one of the 76 passengers on flight 4819. Delta will now be offering all of them $30,000 each.
There's some people in pretty tough shape, and $30,000 right now would be extremely helpful.
21 people were hurt, one of them still in the hospital, but miraculously everyone survived. Investigators now trying to determine what went wrong, if it was severe weather or human error. Delta CEO Ed Bastian speaking to CBS.
It was an experienced crew. All these pilots trained for these conditions. They fly under all kinds of conditions at all the airports in which we operate.
And again, that is unconditional money, so it's not going to impact any future settlements. Now, the CEO of Delta Airlines, Ed Bastian, was on Good Morning America. And, you know, sure enough, they just, you know, can't help themselves. Gail King on CBS. I said Good Morning America. I meant to say CBS morning show. She had to ask the CEO of Delta when she was interviewing them whether Donald Trump may have made things more dangerous for you. Let's just put it this way. She did not get the answer she obviously was hoping to get. Have a listen.
No, the Trump administration recently fired many employees of the FAA administration. Do those cuts worry you? And do you think that impacts the safety? I know you just said it's the safest way to travel, but after looking at all these mishaps, a lot of people are very nervous. Do these cuts affect you?
The cuts do not affect us, Gail. I've been in close communication with the Secretary of Transportation. I understand that the cuts at this time are something that are raising questions, but the reality is there's over 50,000 people that work at the FAA, and the cuts, I understand, were 300 people, and they were in non-critical safety functions. The Trump administration has committed to investing deeply in terms of improving the overall technologies that are used in the air traffic control systems and modernizing the skies. They've committed to hiring additional controllers and investigators and safety investigators. So, no, I'm not concerned with that at all.
Good for him. Again, that's Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta. You know, Chuck Schumer posts the following tweet. He says, I'm thankful that everyone in the flight incident in Toronto that took off from Minneapolis is safe, but we keep seeing these incidents day after day. Meanwhile, Trump's doing massive layoffs at the FAA, including safety specialists, and making our skies less and less safe. Let me give you the numbers again, as you just heard from the CEO of Delta. 50,000 FAA employees, 300 layoffs, none of them in a safety role. So, again, we're so used to seeing this, aren't we? Remember, all of the claims being made at these rallies and these press conferences and members of Congress saying, here they are responding to disasters caused by a shortage of employees by cutting employees and making the skies even less safe, trying to create a public panic and lying through their teeth. The percentage of the FAA workforce that was laid off, about two-thirds of 1%, two-thirds of 1%. Less than 1%. And then, of course, the politicians say, so naturally the, air quotes, mainstream media need to ask that question. Well, what about these severe cuts, which are not severe? What impact is this having on safety? And luckily, this CEO just set the record straight. Good for him for doing so. And by the way, the impression you get, understandably, you know, with the disaster in Toronto and the collision with the helicopter and the airplane, you know, Reagan National Airport, and then the crash of the charter jet in Philadelphia. You know, all very tragic accidents. But what might surprise you is that the number of plane accidents in the month of January was actually less than we've seen in any January in the last 25 years. Usually there's between 75 and 110, you know, accidents of various types of all types of aircraft. And it wasn't 100. It wasn't 75. In January, it was 62. In February, the number is way down. So while the accidents are certainly more dramatic, plane crashes are actually on a downward trend in this country, and they have been for 25 years. I'm talking about both fatal and non-fatal airline crashes and accidents. My source, by the way, for this is the National Transportation Safety Board. And I'm looking at the graph right here, and it shows that the number of accidents are down by about 25%. So again, that's just a little bit of context to go with all of the, you know, headlines and all of the, oh my God, massive layoffs. No, that's just a lie. That's just not true. And that point's already been made and emphasized and reinforced. But again, there's politicians who are happy to mislead. And we're here to make sure they don't get away with it. You're listening to the John Carlson Show. Oh my goodness, we got young Zach, his favorite segment of the day coming up, social media from socialists on The Commute with Carlson. 25 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, young Zach in for Philip J. Vandervoort III. His favorite segment, social media from socialists. What do we got going?
Well, only my favorite segment because we don't offer lunch as one of our honor segments. But the social media from socialists brought to you by the Muckleshoot Casino Resort.
We are considering a happy hour.
Oh, I could do that. A little early. That's more of an afternoon show gig, I think, unfortunately. But I just got a call from a KVI listener that she was hoping I could pass to you. Astute observation. She lives down by the FAA building in Des Moines. Her name's Eileen, and she noticed that during COVID, for the last several years, the parking lot has been nearly empty, almost no one at the office. And then all of a sudden that she kind of worked out about how many people she knows work there and how many people would allegedly be laid off per the statistics that CBS that was citing. So that'd be about six people out of that parking lot, she said, would be gone every day. Well, the parking lot has just now become full again because of the return to work mandate. So she just wanted to throw that out. That
you can thank Andy Jassy at Amazon, and you can thank Donald Trump for getting private sector and now public sector employees get back to the office. Now there's going to be more government, you know, there's going to be more city managers, mayors, and governors and county executives telling their workers to start returning to the office as well. And there's going to be more company leaders who are demanding the same.
So I'm going to hedge my bets and agree with Eileen that we are safer in the skies with more employees at the office than a couple more employees working from home. But anyway, speaking of working from home, I bring you a tweet that came to my attention via the account of Socialist State Representative Sean Scott.
Oh, yes. From University District. Hard left. A protege, by the way, a protege of Shama Sawant. And he just got elected to the legislature.
Met him a few times. Not a likable guy. Anyway.
No. That's the thing about the left. People on the far left are unhappy people.
Mm-hmm.
They're perpetually grouchy. Even when they win, they're grouchy. They're in a bad mood.
Well, buckle up for this set of tweets, though.
Okay.
So it stems from the original tweets from an account called The Random Recruiter. It appears to be like a tech recruiter, headhunter type. And essentially, it's a meme that shows a tombstone that says, remote work 2020 to 2024. And he said, how did you guys fumble remote work that badly? And this account that Sean Scott reposts, I don't even know how to say all the stuff in her, what the account name is. But the bio says the official one-eyed trans girl of Twitter. She, her, hashtag free Palestine. And this is what she writes in response to this tech recruiter's criticism of how did you guys fumble remote work that badly. She says, no one fumbled it. Remote work was murdered by middle managers and corporate executives who genuinely hate and mistrust the employees who do all the actual work.
Oh, well, if all the actual work was getting done, why do they want them back at the office?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm guessing
there's a question for the ages.
I'm guessing she might not have a job, But that's just my speculation. So anyway, I thought that was funny on our riffing on our conversations about remote work. And then one more tweet from a reliable source, Old Faithful, as I would call the account of social media from socialist Pramila Jayapal.
Yes.
Says undocumented immigrants paid nearly $100 billion in federal taxes each year into programs they aren't eligible to receive benefits from.
Good.
Last night, Trump signed an executive order barring them from accessing many of these same programs.
Nice.
This order does nothing but villainize immigrants.
No, it says that you're in a country you haven't been invited to. You're in a country you cut the line and jumped into. Don't expect to be treated like a legal resident or a citizen when you are illegally working and collecting a paycheck here.
And to me, this just seems like bad politics. Pick your battles. You are on the losing side of everything in federal politics right now. Are you really going to die on the hill of illegal immigrants aren't receiving welfare services? Maybe start with like, well, we should let them stay. Maybe get to welfare when you get down that path. But I hate to tell you,
we need to get back to the old standard we had, which is if you are a immigrant, even if you're a legal immigrant, you are expected to have a sponsor, and the sponsor is to be accountable for your well-being, and you are not to access welfare services when you are in this country as a guest. Getting back to that standard. Again, that's for legal immigrants. Why would illegal immigrants be able to get food stamps or get unemployment insurance, which
or luxury hotel rooms
trying to do in Olympia? Or luxury hotel rooms. That got caught by Elon Musk, and that money got clawed back. By the way, just announced minutes ago, Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, the longest-serving majority leader of the United States Senate in either party, relinquished his leadership role this year. John Thune from South Dakota is your new Senate majority leader. Mitch McConnell has announced his retirement. He will not be running for re-election, I believe, in 2 years. So Mitch McConnell stepping, not resigning from the Senate, just retiring, not running for another term. At least that's what we've heard so far. All right. To the news I was just telling you about, we've got a great hero in the Washington State Patrol who stopped someone, not potentially, definitely stopped a wrong-way impaired driver from hurtling eastbound into the westbound lanes of I-90, and did so by crashing their car head-on with the impaired driver trying to drive the wrong way on an interstate highway. This all went down this morning, shortly before 4 in the morning. Driver merged onto I-90 at 405, almost hit a car that was driving in the right direction. This driver was driving in the wrong direction. And then a state trooper had to use their vehicle to stop the car from going too far on I-90, and it would just be a matter of time before they hit someone at a blindingly fast rate of speed. Remember, it was earlier this week when a suspected impaired driver driving the wrong way on Highway 167 was struck by a truck who was driving the right way on 167. The driver of the car was killed, and it created a huge 8-mile backup, a massive traffic jam. At the very least, that likely would have happened on I-90 today, this morning, were it not for the actions of this trooper. Here's Como 4's Theron Zahn.
Amazingly, in all of this, no one was seriously hurt, but certainly it was just scary for some time this morning. Wrong way driver traveling eastbound on the westbound lanes of I-90. An innocent driver swerving to get out of the way of that driver, again, going the wrong way. And then a trooper dispatched to stop that driver. The trooper doing what their training tells them to do. In a last case scenario, you got to put your trooper vehicle in front of that wrong way driver. And that's exactly what that trooper did, colliding head on with that car. In fact, at one point, before
before the impact, that wrong way driver was swerving to try to avoid the trooper to continue going the wrong way. But the trooper did not let that happen. Even though it was a head on impact, there's not serious injuries in all this.
No serious injuries. But get this, that car that the trooper deliberately struck head on to prevent that driver from careening down the wrong way on I-90, that car was going at 60 miles an hour. So that trooper knew that he or she were trying to find out who it was. They knew that they were literally cruising for a bruising, that they were going to be injured. And they put their state patrol vehicle in the way anyway. And that is why we did not see a replay of Highway 167, a potential catastrophic replay of Highway 167 from earlier this week. So we've been trying to find out who this trooper was. I'm sure we'll know within the next hour or two. But we do know that the driver was believed to be impaired, arrested for DUI. That the driver was injured, but not seriously, and that the trooper was injured and knew that they were bound to be injured, and they still did it anyway, still used their car to prevent even worse danger to the traveling public. The car ended up being brought to a stop near Westlake Sammamish Parkway, so it was all contained within Bellevue. All right, it is coming up here on 43 minutes after 8 o'clock this morning. Don't know. Oh, wait, we got him. Young Zach, you are a young hero. You are an absolute hero, not just a young hero. You're a thank you for making this happen. Trooper Johnson. All right, great to have you on the air with us this morning. I've been raving since 6 in the morning what a hero this state trooper was.
Well, appreciated, and absolutely.
Tell us more of the details of what happened here, and again, how this trooper knew that he or she was going to be injured, and they did this anyway to make sure the public stayed safe.
So around, I don't know, probably a little more before 2:30, I believe is when it was.
Yeah,
we started getting calls of a vehicle that was traveling eastbound on the westbound lanes of I-90. The first call was right around the area of where 405 crosses over I-90. We continued getting some calls as it continued eastbound on the westbound lanes. The trooper was able to intercept that vehicle around Westlake Sammamish and placed his vehicle in a position to stop the other vehicle. Thankfully, it wasn't a real high-speed collision, but there was definitely damage done.
We were told the reports we had earlier was that the car was going at 60 miles an hour.
Well, at some point in time, maybe. And I don't have the exact speed for what the collision happened, but
that was what Como reported earlier, Rick.
Okay, yeah, I don't. We don't know the speeds that were going. I know that the trooper had their lights on and was approaching this vehicle. From what I can tell, you know, it looks like the vehicle, you know, was going slower than a freeway speed, but of course, okay, I don't have exact information. Was able to, you know, get this vehicle stopped by placing himself in danger, of course.
Yeah.
Was able to get out of his vehicle and assess the driver that had the vehicle. And subsequently, other troopers arrived, of course, and that individual was placed in custody for suspected impairment. Both the trooper and the wrong-way driver were taken to the hospital and released. I'm not sure how long they were there. The trooper now is home and resting.
Nice.
And the suspect, from what I understand, was booked into jail.
Even nicer. Very, very good. Well, I'll tell you, we know very well how this could have ended because we saw how it ended a few days ago on Highway 167, right?
Right. And, you know, I guess, you know, my thoughts go to if this wasn't stopped and you have somebody travel along that doesn't know this vehicle is coming at freeway speeds. Mm-hmm. I mean, this trooper saved probably severe injury and possibly even worse.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, that's what, and really that's what we do. Our job is to keep the roadway safe. And in this situation, you know, he put himself in danger to make sure that no other vehicles were struck.
Well, I'll tell you, I hope that the chief of the state patrol, and for that matter, I hope the governor offers a commendation for doing so. That really is, talk about, you know, putting yourself in harm's way, quite literally, putting yourself in harm's way to protect the public.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Rick Johnson, Washington State Patrol, thank you for getting back to us here on very short notice and giving us an extra layer of detail here on what happened this morning.
All right. Have a great day.
You too, Rick. That is Trooper Rick Johnson, Washington State Patrol here. Brianna Keeler from CNN has roots here in Washington State. I'm not sure we should be proud of that, but... she used to work, I believe it was in the Tri-Cities when she was in her very early media career. She was raised in California. And now, of course, at CNN, she is ardently anti-Trump. Though, again, as CNN, somehow they think if you have the title of CNN anchor, that means you don't have a political agenda. She does. It's very obvious. Anyway, Stephen Miller was on talking about DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, with Brianna Keeler. This is, of course, Elon Musk's portfolio that he handles for the president. And Brianna wants to know, hey, who's in charge of DOGE? And what, you know, why are they doing what they're doing? Stephen Miller was so patient with her. Have a listen.
So who is in charge of DOGE?
The President of the United States.
He's the administrator of DOGE?
No, the DOGE is the what was formerly U.S. Digital Services. It's an agency of the federal government that reports into the office of the Executive Office of the President, which reports to the President of the United States.
Okay.
The way that Article 2 works is a president wins an election, and then he appoints staff, including myself, including Mike Waltz, including Susie Wiles,
yes,
including Elon Musk, and those staff report to him.
Okay, well aware. So Elon Musk, a week ago, answered a question about transparency at DOGE. This is how he spoke about DOGE.
Well, we actually are trying to be as transparent as possible. In fact, our actions, we post our actions to the DOGE handle on X and to the DOGE website.
So you hear him there. We post our actions. All of our actions are maximally transparent. Does Elon Musk know he's not in charge of DOGE?
Again, the president runs the government, then the president appoints advisors, including Elon, including myself, including all the other staff here at the White House, and then those staff in turn execute the president's commands and directions to all the agencies of the federal government. This is how democracy works, something that we treasure in America. The whole American people go to the ballot box, they elect the president appoints staff, the staff that administer his orders and directives across the whole U.S. government.
Okay, I thought he was going to have to reach for the crayons at one point, but he explained it all very nicely. And, you know, the media are trying to, who's really in charge? For heaven's sakes, it's very clear who's really in charge. Does anyone have any doubt that Donald Trump is calling the shots, that Elon Musk is following an assignment he received from Donald Trump, that Donald Trump wants him to do precisely what he is doing, just as Tom Homan on the border, on the southern border, is doing exactly what Donald Trump wants him to do, and he's doing it really well. So this is just one more example of a CNN reporter and their agenda getting out there and making themselves look silly.